Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness. This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it's so what?
The police in riot gear with Trump. I am ashamed to call myself a European.
Recognition of Guaido.
Unelected gobshite.
Is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and so I would reprimand you over that.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to I Foresee Trouble with Dalian Wallace. Another week in the European Parliament, another week of many things to talk about. Today's episode, we're finally back on the choo-choo train through Europe on our Euro trip, and we're going right to Paris. So France is our country of the week. We'll get to that later in the show. We have a lot to say about France, you can probably imagine.
Oh, yeah.
But first, we'll talk a bit about what has been happening lately in the Parliament, in our big votes. But in the news today, there was quite an important development in terms of the TRIPS waiver around the COVID vaccines. This has been a call from India and South Africa at the WTO to lift the patents and to make the vaccine more accessible for production elsewhere. And the USA is now supporting this. So it's completely changed its position, and it's kind of left the EU in an awkward place because they've been staunchly defending the private property of these big pharma companies. And now President von der Leyen is in an awkward position, and she's kind of now supporting the waiver as well. So that's kind of the news
today.
I think
you're being very polite, Damien. I think
I'm a polite person.
Well, Damien is a polite boy.
They've made a holy show of themselves yet again. I mean, talk about revealing yourself as an absolute sort of indentured slave of Big Pharma first and foremost, batting away for them to keep their profits and stop the generic manufacture of the vaccine, and then eventually under public pressure or whatever the US give in, and then they're left looking like total idiots, and they're going to just go, oh yeah, okay. So yeah, now they're exposing themselves as being the puppets of the US yet
but
again.
It's so blatant, it's because we have heard from the mouth of von der Leyen a categorical no on this question. It's been raised numerous times in the past few months, and she's been absolutely steadfastly against this
was discussed at a European Council meeting. Not one 27 member state was in favour of the waiver. Not one out of 27. And I find it a bit rich. Simon Coveney, who I actually have a bit of time for, but I find it a bit rich this morning that he's welcoming the US decision on the waiver. But I mean,
it's actually a joke.
We've been putting in FOIs about the TRIPS waiver and the dialogue between three different departments, including his one, Foreign Affairs, Trade and Health. And we've been putting in FOIs. It has been blatantly obvious that Ireland has opposed the lifting of the waiver, right? They have opposed it and they've shown no interest in it. Now, all of a sudden, America has decided they're going for it, and now we think it's a good idea. Would you be well?
Well, it's very bad of Simon like to pretend like that they are an uninvolved bystander, like, you know. But I mean, I do think the biggest thing of it all, it says that none of the 27 EU countries have any morals or principles at all on this issue, other than to follow what the US do, which is a point actually we've been making in terms of a lot of EU policies. And if that's the future of Europe, well, then they can have their Future of Europe conference and celebrate Europe Day on Sunday. But the European Union is on a really rapid
Maybe we should have Europe Day in Washington.
I think it would make total sense. Very true.
But it's really like playing second fiddle all the time and really just waiting for the first move on that side. It's kind of sad. But the good thing is there's support at least for the waiver. Let's see what happens. It has to be negotiated, of course. Mm-hmm. And also, we didn't mention, but if you haven't listened, we had a special episode last week on the Digital Green Certificate, which is this new kind of what would you call it in layman's
terms?
They say
it's going to open up the economy to yeah. foreign travel again, yip, yip and all yeah, of that. But so it's a stunt really on behalf yeah, of the Commission yeah. to pretend to be
so
doing something.
Listen back to our last episode about that, and that's in progress as well, the negotiations.
Yeah,
so
and a lot of people were in touch like yeah. saying to us about, you know, a few questions on it about, you know, could Ireland... Is Ireland going to be bound by it and all this kind of thing? I think the first thing to say is that the negotiations haven't concluded yet. The Council, the Commission and the Parliament are sitting down and discussing this over the next month. But yeah, member states can bring in their own rules and all of that if they want. But it's one to watch.
Yeah. So that's that episode if you want to listen back. And of course, we have over 50 episodes now. So there's plenty of material for you to go back and listen to catch up. But besides that, other things that have been happening in the Parliament that nobody's talking about, we mentioned a bit last week, is the EDF, the European Defence Fund. Claire, tell us about what just happened, because it's been pretty monumental.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. look, at, I mean, it's for the first time that the European Parliament and the European budgets are going to directly fund military research and development, which is an incredibly retrograde step and one in which we certainly believe that a majority of Ireland people wouldn't, Irish people wouldn't want any part of that. I mean, for God's sake, it's 8 billion euros now. They wanted more, but obviously had to claw it back a bit with COVID and all the rest. But it's just one of many, as I called it, slush funds for the arms industry, and it's really not.
Let's have a little listen to your speech in the plenary.
We often talk in here about how far we come, but you know what? This fund for me is an indication of how low we've sunk. A union that was supposed to be designed for peace, signing off for the first time on a slush fund of 8 billion euros for weapons of slaughter directly from an EU budget. A fund designed by the arms industry for the arms industry. For God's sake, we even have a peace facility where African countries can buy back some of those weapons. And then when they use them and refugees come to our shores, the same companies benefit from the contracts to keep them out. You couldn't make it up. Isn't it time we change tack? The citizens and communities devastated by COVID have a hell of a lot better things to be doing with spending 8 billion euros on. The Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw made the point, wars don't decide who is right, but who's left. Western interventionism has left millions widowed, orphaned, stateless, homeless. It's time to call a halt, support the left's resolution to reject this madness.
It's yet another example of the dangerous militarisation and how the resources of the European Union are not being used to benefit the people. But it's only one example of that.
Yeah, and I mean, and linked to that militarization of Europe was my contribution on Russia last week, which proved to be fairly controversial. but really, this painting of Russia as a big bad bear, as if they're about to attack us, does serve the people who want to increase the militarization of Europe. And as we keep telling you, the European member states have increased their military spend by approximately 30% since 2014. And I can assure you, we have not seen the same increases in housing provision or in health matters or anything remotely like it. But last week there was a resolution on Russia, and it was so pathetic. It was actually hard to credit that what they were saying and what they were doing. Now, there was three prongs to the attack on Russia last week, the latest resolution attacking Russia. Now, first of all, they were given out about the Russian build-up on the Ukraine border. But I highlighted the fact that we never seem to talk about the fact that Western interference in the Ukraine has completely destabilized the region and has pauperized Ukraine. And I don't know if people remember, but there was a coup in 2014 which the Western powers organized. The Americans paid for it. And Obama's representative there at the time, Nuland, was actually caught. She was caught on the telephone, giving out about Europe not helping enough, and boasting that the US had spent $5 billion orchestrating the coup. Right, and of course, here in the European Parliament, they deny that it even happened. So that was one angle of it. Another angle was, in the Czech Republic, a story came out that 7 years ago, the two Russian individuals were accused of carrying out an act of terrorism, and it was an explosion, right? And they reckoned that the Russians were involved in it, and there were some people killed. But nothing was heard of this story for 7 years. And by all accounts, according to people that we were talking to in the Czech Republic,
including the Czech Prime Minister,
the story is actually much more connected to the Czech elections this autumn, rather than anything the Russians did. And as you said, Damien, the Czech president Zeman has come out and said, well, in actual fact, we have no proof of that. Oh, come on, like. I mean, and so, the European Parliament has done resolutions on it. And the third item then was, of course, Navalny. Navalny had protests down the street because he was on hunger strike and he couldn't get medical attention, but in actual fact he had got it the previous day, and he admits that he's actually doing grand and that he's all the medical help that he needs afterwards, right? But he let the protests go ahead, and we have the Europeans jumping up and down and going mad that the Russians haven't investigated the poisoning of Navalny. But in actual fact, what's come to light now is that the OPCW and Germany refused, and the OPCW are the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which we've been speaking about a lot of late. But it came to light that the OPCW and Germany have refused to supply the Russian authorities with Navalny's biomedical samples so that they could initiate an investigation. And then they're giving out about the Russians for not doing it. I mean, unbelievable they are.
I think this resolution on Russia is probably the weirdest thing that's been tabled to the plenary this whole mandate, because it's about three-pronged issue, like you said, Mick, all hypothetical things. So it's talking about if Russia were to invade Ukraine, and if it is true that this Czech bomb is related to Russia, and if Navalny had already stopped his hunger strike at that stage as well, there was no build-up on the Russian-Ukrainian border at that stage that we're voting on this resolution. So it's just weird to be voting on something that's not an issue, actually. It was kind of fabricated.
People must find it incredible to believe that that the US is presently spending more than 10 times more per year on military than Russia. More than 10 times more. And the EU itself is spending more than three times what Russia is spending. And you would think that Russia was about to take over the world with its armies.
And they're spending that despite the fact that NATO and its allies are rightly positioned on the borders of Russia as it stands anyway. So there's no Russian army sitting off the coast of Florida or California or any of that. And I mean, it is something people might think we go on about it a fair bit, but we're only responding to the agenda that's been set in the parliament here. And it is really important to say that this is the reignition of the Cold War all over again. The demonization of Russia without any factual basis whatsoever is incredibly dangerous for the citizens of Europe and the world. And we think we've a responsibility to call that out wherever we see it. And then we get dubbed as being Putin puppets and all this kind of thing and go back to Russia where we've never, I've never been there. Mick's been there for football, but I've never been there. I'd like to go, but I haven't been there yet. But all of this stuff, but it's actually incredibly important because this is the strategic orientation and propaganda which is laying the basis for public money being spent on arms and militarization rather than the benefit of citizens. And so it's actually hugely important.
It is,
and then at the same time, we had a discussion on Colombia where the Commissioner Johansson was eulogising Eamon Gilmore, of course, who our Irish listeners will remember as the former leader of the Labour Party and Taoiseach. Probably that's enough said. Eamon Gilmore, of course, went on to be the EU special representative in Colombia. And Commissioner Johansson was saying about what a brilliant job he's doing over there. What a great guy. And he's so good that they wanted to extend his mandate there. And they were delighted that he'd agreed to stay on. And what's going on in Colombia now?
Right now, Colombia has the worst human rights record on the planet. And Duque's government, he's a far right wing, bad piece of work, and the European Union is supporting him. And we had Eamon Gilmore over there as the EU's special envoy. And he's also actually the EU's EU's special representative for human rights, and human rights abuses in Colombia are off the Richter scale, and Europe is pretending that everything is grand. And MEPs who seem to know nothing about what's going on in Colombia lined up in the parliament last week to tell us how wonderful everything is.
There's people being murdered and butchered in the streets.
To listen to them. It was really painful.
But I mean, not only over the past period has there been a record numbers of executions of community leaders and trade union leaders and so on. That has massively escalated in the past period, with literally people being executed on the streets. And the same people who say everything's great in Colombia talk about Venezuela, where there's been problems in Venezuela, but there's none of that kind of thing going on there or anywhere else either. It's not happening in Russia either. Unbelievable.
It's amazing selectivity, isn't it? Just
shocking. But in any way, case, there is a response, and we'll be out protesting today about Colombia with our colleagues.
Yeah, 5:30 this evening, the report is outside the parliament. Yeah.
Tell us about fish, because that's another thing that was happening recently. Well, a lot of talk on fish.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of discussion on fish at the moment, and I got a chance to speak on it in the plenary last week because there was a vote on the trade and cooperation agreement, which I explained to the Parliament was a complete disaster for Irish fishing and coastal communities in Ireland. Ireland is actually losing 15% of its share of fish quota. And just for comparison, the French are losing 8% of theirs, which was multiples of ours in the first place. And Spain, which is a long way from the UK waters, is only losing 4%. Now, I mean, there is no fairness whatever in that. And I mean, we're talking about the fact, naturally, the UK, we're not giving out about the UK. The UK are getting back more rights over the waters that flow around the UK. And we were always going to lose some of it. But it hasn't been done fairly. And while the Trade and Cooperation Agreement has been passed by Parliament, will go all the way and it will be passed. But there's no doubt about it, but when this is all over, the EU has to look at getting concessions from the bigger member states in order to give Ireland a fair share. And we have a couple of problems as well with, there's a Brexit adjustment reserve, it's called, and this is where money is being given to the countries that are most hit by the UK withdrawal. And in fairness, the manner in which the Commission is dividing the money up between the member states affected is a fair system on this on occasion. But what we have now is we have, there's reports being done at committee level, and the Budget Committee and the Fisheries Committee, for example, the rapporteurs for both committees happen to be French, and they're looking to change the financial divvying out of the money so that France gets more and Ireland gets less. Now, I mean, this would be a disaster for Ireland. It's bad enough that we're already losing too big a share of our fish quota. But the Commission has to hold strong on this. And even if the committees come up with this proposal to give France even more of this money from the Brexit Adjustment Reserve, it has to be fought. I mean, people have this notion that Europe is about levelling the playing field. Well, unfortunately, we're starting to see more and more of the bigger buys getting more of what they want. Now, there's a few other controversies going on with fishing as well, which I should just touch on for a few minutes. The EU Council and the European Parliament have agreed an informal deal on the distribution of the €6 billion budget for fishing for the next 7 years. But unfortunately, it is going to lead to further overfishing. It's mostly been designed to favour the big buys and the factory ships that are hoovering the fish off the seabed and decimating fish stocks and destroying the fishing industry for coastal communities all around Ireland. Because we're not getting our fair share of the fish, and we have the likes of the Spaniards and the French, and the Portuguese, taking an astronomical amount of fish from the sea. And unfortunately, the EU, despite all the recommendations by the environmental groups to deal with it, they have not tackled the factory ships, they have not tackled the overfishing. Now, people might have heard, and in fairness to him, Michael Clifford in The Examiner has given a very good coverage, but there's been a change. There's been a big controversy in Ireland over, there was a big report done about how the fish were weighed when they came to land. And there was an audit done of how this was being assessed in Ireland. And it turned out that they reckon the figures, there was cheating going on and they weren't being weighed properly. And they reckon that Ireland is overfishing. So what they've done is, they used to weigh the fish at the factories, but now they're going to make them weigh the fish where they land. And it's actually, it's going to be a new big expense for Irish fishermen and women in Ireland. But the European Commission has come out and they've literally said, OK, we're stopping it. But they're stopping it for everybody. And the audit showed that there was 33 people accused of manipulating the weights over the last couple of years and that only one had been charged, right? But, I mean, that doesn't mean that everyone is guilty. It's a bit like banning everyone off the road because some people are speeding. I mean, it's just nonsense. Mm. But the EU has come down with a sledgehammer they've done away with the derogation where you're allowed to weigh the fish at the factory. And this is a really another big blow to European fishing and or to Irish fishing. But I mean, we've been pointing out, unfortunately, with successive Irish governments, fishing hasn't got the priority that it deserves. When we joined the European Union, as people know, we sold out our fishing rights in return for subsidies for dairy, mostly. So we were allowed to make millionaires of our dairy farmers and we were allowed to pauperise the fishing community. And listen, this isn't just about fishermen and women around Ireland. It's also about the communities they live in. I mean, you're decimating coastal villages, decimating them by taking away their livelihood. And you have an impact on a whole lot of livelihoods in the area by decimating the livelihood of the fishing people. It just doesn't make sense. And it's something that has to be dealt with. And there is a new approach required.
Well, I think it's no coincidence that this has re-emerged as a very controversial and topical issue following Brexit, because it was one of the reasons actually why Brexit got accepted by the people of Britain was to regain control over their coastal waters. And I mean, you're right, the original betrayal happened when Ireland and followed England really into joining the EEC. At the time, Norway was going to be in the mix as well, but the deal was done at the 11th hour to sort of say, by sleight of hand, take our fishing in return for agriculture, and the lads went along with that and sold it out. Now Norway ended up not joining and has a really healthy fishing industry now, whereas Ireland and the UK had been very badly hit. So I think it's kind of chickens coming home to roost that it's re-emerged again, and it is going to be really important. I mean, the sea for an island like Ireland is some of our best. It's akin to some of our best agricultural land. It is our land, it is our territory, and it's a shock and shame the amount of revenue even that we've lost since our membership of the European Union. What we've lost in fishing rights has more than outweighed what we've, inverted commas, gained from EU membership.
But the real sad part about it is, if you're just talking about agriculture, right, and the fishing people who have lost out most are the less well off, the people with the small boats. And likewise, with farming in Ireland, the farmers that are suffering the most in Ireland are the smaller farmers. And as we've pointed out, unfortunately, 80% of the CAP money, the Common Agricultural Policy money from the European Union, 80% of the money is still going to go to the 20% richest farmers, whereas in actual fact, it's the other 80% of the farmers that need it. So not only are we showing favouritism towards the big farmers, but we're also showing it towards the big fishermen. And that's not how it should be.
Yeah. On other news, there's another thing you were speaking on in the plenary, Claire, on space. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, it's just an interesting one because it seems a bit abstract and all of that. But actually, believe it or not, space is the new frontier, and that just doesn't happen in Star Wars. It's actually a huge topic over here, and a lot of public money is going into investment in space. The dangerous part and the thing that would concern me is in terms of the declared statements by people in here that they need to invest in space in order to be a geopolitical player. And we've seen space being used now for increased militarization. So that's really regrettable. I mean, historically, there was a strong cooperative tradition in terms of space. But recently, NATO and the US have been ratcheting things up against Russia, sanctions, Russophobia and so on, with the result that actually the Russians have recently withdrawn from the International Space Station, which is really regrettable because this was one of the most recognised benefits, if you like, of the diplomacy in the post-war period. So again, it's the same thing. Why are we wasting massive amounts of public money in order to develop a militarisation in space when we could be actually working and using diplomacy and cooperation to build a way forward? And the point that I was going to make, but I didn't get a chance because my minute and a half wasn't long enough, was that it does seem now, and it's something we'll maybe return to, that not content with destroying this planet, the European Union is hell-bent on going on and ruining outer space as well with its increased involvement there. And we're all paying for the privilege.
Yeah.
Mad stuff, you know, really. It reminded me of the Muppets, Pigs in Space was all I could think of. But anyway.
Grand. Okay, let's get on to our next segment, which is, of course, our country stop. And we're in one of the biggest in the European Union this week. It's France. So Mick, kick us off with a few fun facts.
Yeah, well, we could have actually done a whole episode on France. And it is a fascinating country. It's probably, after Germany, it's probably the biggest player in the European Union after Germany. Germany is the number one. France will be number two in terms of influence. I mean, it has the second biggest population as well in the European Union with 67 million plus. Germany has about a little over 80 at the moment. Only Turkey will be bigger than them, which is obviously not in the EU. Turkey has about 87 million. But it's a really fascinating country. And just, I suppose, traditionally, France has had high taxation and has had powerful public services. For example, corporation tax, which is 12.5% in Ireland, it's 28% in France. And if your turnover is over 250 million a year, you actually pay more. So we do it the other way around. The bigger you are and the better off you are and the more money you're making, the less we charge you. Mm-hmm. Like Google pay less than 2%. But in France, you pay extra. You pay 31% if your turnover is over 250 million. And they do have powerful healthcare. They have a very good system there. And they traditionally had a great pension scheme. But that now is under pressure. And Macron came in to government in 2017 riding on a promise of reform. He was going to reform. There's over 40 different pension schemes seemingly in France, and he was going to roll them all into the one. But really what he was doing was he was reducing what money people were going to get in their old age. And the other big reform he was doing was he was going to reduce unemployment benefit in a big way. But there was uproar when he started doing this. And even though he came into power in 2017, he actually didn't get at the parliament until early 2020, last year. And there was so much opposition to it, even from parliamentarians. The legislation that was going to bring in the pension reform, there was over 41,000 amendments put in to stop it going through. And There's a law in France, it's Article 49.3, I think it's called. De Gaulle brought it in, he says, in the interest of strong government. And it actually, this law allows you to overrule Parliament. But there was going to be uproar and strikes started straight away. And there was a lot of strikes even before this, but they were amplified. And then COVID came and the government actually withdrew it. because there was too many problems. And Macron more or less admitted that he just wasn't going to get it across the line because of COVID, because of the strikes, because of all the opposition, that he wouldn't get it across the line before April 2022, when the next elections are. But if Macron gets into power next year, I can guarantee you he has made no secret of the fight. It's already in their calculations for dealing with COVID that this has to come in and all this money is going to be clawed back to deal with it.
I think, yeah, France is obviously a really interesting country and it is one of the big players in here. Their presence is huge. Of course it is. I remember when I used to work in Dublin Airport and we'd be trying to organise strikes or whatever, always people would say, I wish we could be more like the French. It was a constant call because it was a country that historically had a really low level of trade union organisation, but actually had no problem in shutting the country down at the drop of a hat their welfare state or their rights or entitlements that they'd built up was under attack. That has been gradually eroded over the past period, in tune with the neoliberal agenda of the European Union. And we've seen that chipped away everywhere. And you've had some really awful Socialist Party governments in France. Now, they'd be the likes of the Labour Party in Ireland, that type of a Socialist Party. And they've been really decimated for their betrayal of French workers, as Mick referred to the big yellow vest protests that erupted in response to the pension reforms. But as a result of all of that chipping away, you've had a kind of a change in politics and it's reflected in the European Parliament. So unlike other countries where the biggest groups have the membership in the EPP and the S&Ds, which are the two biggest groups in the European Parliament, the French have hardly anything in either of those groups. They have a pitiful 8 in the EPP, which is the biggest group, and only 6, and they had only 5. One was a Brexit edition in the S&D group. So that's
the total of 79 MEPs.
Out of 79 MEPs. So it shows you about French politics. So the main two groups in the European Parliament, France is massively underrepresented in both of these groups. Where their MEPs are dominant is the biggest group was the far right, the French National Front. Or
Rassemblement National.
Marie Le Pen's party got 23 MEPs elected. Second up, but one was a Brexit edition. So also now on 23 was Macron's group, who are in Renew, who are the kind of liberal, but liberal meaning far right in terms of economic policy and pretty far right in terms of their foreign policy as well. Actually, ironically, Renew attacked Marie Le Pen for not being strong enough in dealing with Muslims recently. So two big far right groups basically dominate. They are 46 of the 79 MEPs. There's 13 Greens. They've made a bit of a show in the last European elections. Mm-hmm. And then there's 6 in La France Insoumise. So they are the Mélenchon's kind of left group, to the left of the Socialist Party.
In the same
party.
Group as you two,
they're in the same group as ourselves in the left group in the European Parliament. Mixed bag.
We couldn't go without mentioning our friend Nathalie Loiseau, the chair of the Security and Defence Committee, who had the great honour of being invited on to Drive Time to do a hatchet job on us. In actual fact, it was more of a hatchet job by the so-called journalist of Drive Time rather than herself, who was facilitated with the type of questions they put to her. But anyway, I'm missing this. We normally actually get on okay with her. But she would be very right-wing, very, very pro-France on foreign policy, no matter what they did. And we've been highlighting the French involvement in the Sahel for a long time, where they're literally robbing the place blind of minerals, mainly uranium, for the French nuclear power plants, which provide 75% of French electricity. But France still behaves very much like a colonial power in several parts of Africa. Colonialism never really went away, despite the fact that these countries were supposed to be given their independence. In actual fact, the likes of the French have a lot to do with choosing many of these leaders still. They're able to make sure that they're able to get their minerals at peanuts of a price.
Yeah.
But another guy, a French guy that I should mention, is the chair of the Envy Committee.
Yeah. Pascal Canfin.
Pascal Canfin is
the Environment Committee. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Environment. Yeah. And I get on fine with him, and I think he's, you know, I've had no great reason to be given out about him very much. I find him a very fair chair, so fair play to him on that. And I think if you're on any of these committees, the chair has amazing power. And if the chair decides not to be fair, they can make life very difficult for you and your chance to get fair representation.
Yeah. He's very fair to you, though, isn't he? You're good buds in that sense.
No.
Yeah, also similarly, Karim Adeli actually is the French Green Party chair of the Tran Committee, and I have to say she's quite fair as well.
And you have, of course, another chair and another committee that you're in on foreign interference.
Oh my God,
Raphael Glucksmann.
Oh God, one of the handful of French S&Ds. He's an awful melt. This fella sees Uyghurs and conspiracies and Chinese hatchet men everywhere. The man is crazy. I mean, I don't know how some of these people sleep at night. They see so many enemies amassed on the borders of Europe that are, you know, foreign interference threats, cyber security threats, hybrid threats, Russian threats, Chinese threats. It's a wonder to get any sleep at all. But I suppose the point we are making is that the French presence is really felt here. And they do pop up in all of the committees. Generally speaking, on the Libe committee, they're quite good. But I think we should mention the whole issue, which is of huge interest in Ireland and everywhere in Europe, even though nobody ever talks about it, which is Strasbourg. And that's the fact that in the EU treaties, it's structured as such to say that the seat of the parliament is in Strasbourg. So we only come together in plenary in Strasbourg once a month. We haven't been travelling due to COVID, but normally we do. And that is something that the European Court of Auditors assessed in 2014 and said it was costing 114 million every year to transport all these MEPs, thousands, 4,000 people, staff and MEPs, travel down to Strasbourg, all the drivers, everything, once a month, have to get hotels and everything else. And then the carbon footprint of that is about 19,000 tons of CO2 emissions to drive all of those people.
Yeah, it's around an additional 40% of the European Parliament's carbon footprint is from having to go to Strasbourg, which is huge.
Crazy.
And the buildings are empty then the rest of the time. So they were said, the same report said if they got rid of the Strasbourg buildings, they'd save over 600 million up front and another 114 million every year. And that was the 2014 figure, so nearly 10 years
and
ago.
And that's even without the cost of the carbon footprint.
Yeah. And the Parliament has taken the position numerous times in votes on resolutions to have a single seat for the European Parliament, because it makes sense. Everyone is in favour, except all of the French who vote against it.
Yeah, and
they say
it's
because of constitutional reasons, but it's basically a subsidy.
It's a bit of a game by the Parliament as well, because everybody votes except the French for one seat, which we should be in the one place, but they don't say what place that should be, which of course it should be Brussels. And there were loads of other options when Brexit happened about European institutions that could move into that big, expensive building and that. And it's shocking that that is not highlighted much in Europe, how much money is wasted on that just to, you know, have this because it's in the treaty and all of that. And the French have to get their bit out of it. Like, you know, it'd be cheaper paying every resident in Strasbourg an annual amount, a couple of grand every year to take it out of there. It's shocking.
Speaking of money, I think people will find it interesting that France is the powerhouse of European agriculture. It is the biggest agricultural producer in Europe. And yet, agriculture only represents 1.6% of French GDP. It only represents 2% of its employment. And yet, the amount of subsidies that they get, so you have 2% of the people getting absolute lion's share of subsidy from the European Union through the medium of agriculture. But, and then you can say, well, where does France actually, what are they all working at? And what is makes up the most part of GDP, and it's probably no surprise that tourism completely dominates, and over 70% of French GDP comes from tourism, and there's something like around 70% of the people employed in the industry. It's incredible. And in 2019, the last year, last normal year, you could say, there was over 90 million visitors to France. 90 million in 1 year. So, I mean, that is a mad figure. Now, I mean, people would be disappointed if I didn't get around to talking about football, speaking about any country. And I should mention Nicola, who works in the great Claire Daly's office, a little Frenchman and a great kid, but he's from Nantes. And he told me, I could not possibly fail to mention the fact that Nantes beat Juventus 2-1 in the European Championships in the Champions League in 1996. And to the best of my knowledge, I think Nicola, he didn't boast of being there, because it would have probably been a lie. I think he was about 4 years of age at the time. So I wouldn't say he was at the match, but he's very proud of the day. Now, I went and I was in Nantes for World Cup games and European Championships over the year. The European Championships were held in France in 82, and I was there for the whole tournament. And I was at the World Cup in 98 for the whole tournament as well. And it was actually a great country for a football tournament. But I should mention that in 2004, I went to Nantes to see Kevin Doyle play with Cork City. Cork were playing Nantes in the Europa League, and it was 2004, and the first game was played in Cork, and it was a 1-1 draw, and Kevin scored, but the second leg, which I was at in Nantes, Nantes won 3-1, but it was a big occasion for Cork at the time.
Absolutely, and of course the French do love their football, and I mean, we normally do a kind of a famous person slot on these country tours, but actually there's so many famous French people.
We start with Thierry Henry.
It's not really necessary, do you know what I mean? There's so many of them, it's really from the obscure country. But just on Nicola, who works with me, I mean, he'd be probably, wouldn't really call himself a kid. Very talented young man. I consider myself lucky to have got him. He came to us from... he had been working with an NGO in terms of transport and environment issues with an Irish guy who I'd been in touch with, and sent us in a CV around the time we got elected. So we waited for a bit because I didn't know what the needs were, but we recruited him for dealing the work on the TRAN committee, particularly with aviation, and he is a great guy. He asked us to mention his parents, Martine and Bernard, his parents, and yeah, he's very proud Nantes man. Actually, our second, we had another French fellow working for us as well, Adern from Strasbourg. So even though we give out about the French here all the time, and we do, we still
we
are
don't
probably
give
one
out
of the
about
few
Nicola.
Delegations who've recruited people outside their own member state.
Now, speaking of Nicola now, and Nicola loves football, but I should make it known that recently I discovered that he never, ever heard of George Best.
Oh, yeah, that was
now, I thought to myself, my God,
shocking.
What planet has this man been living on? Yeah. He'd never heard of George Best. Yeah.
Anyway, back to France for a sec, because there's a few other things I want to hear you say, which we haven't talked about, how France is one of the only European member states with so many overseas territories, as they like to be called. We have French Guyana, French Polynesia, Guadeloupe, Martinique. We have these all dotted around the globe. And they're actually part of the European Union. They're
unreal.
Not. So these are territories that get a load of funding. If you look at your €5, you'll see a little chunk, a little square on the map. That's a big part of Latin America. It's French Guiana, which is actually France. And they use the euro. So France is very particular in that regard as well. It has Réunion. So it's really all across the globe. You see little dots of French territory.
We have MEPs here who come from islands
from Réunion,
off the coast of
Madagascar,
Australia, nearly, and they're,
New Caledonia.
They're MEPs. Did you ever?
Well, we did say that France never gave up on colonialism, and it's still a colonial power, especially in how it manages to extract from a lot of countries, obviously mainly in Africa. But
The other thing is, it's a big nuclear powerhouse,
exactly,
and actually, it's kind of odd in Western Europe. It's the only one that's really talking about nuclear all the time. We see loads of nuclear amendments, so they kind of side up with the Eastern Europeans on that.
Yeah.
That comes up a lot. Yeah, so...
And do you know that Ireland is going to buy some energy now from France?
The Celtic interconnector, yeah.
In order for us to be able to build data centres, which are absolutely hoovering up a huge portion of Irish energy, in order for us to be able to do that, we're now going to import energy from France, which will come from the nuclear plants, and it's going to come in a cable under the sea. But it was interesting that after meeting the French and doing the deal, we had Varadkar and the Minister for Defence at the time, and along with an entourage from RTE, they went out and toured the Sahel. And before we knew it, Ireland were sending a few troops out to the Sahel to aid the French mission of impoverishing the local people and robbing uranium from the place. And Ireland has signed up to that now as well. And it was interesting that RTE thought it was a great venture at the time as well.
Mm. Well, I think it is. And I mean, you've said it and we've said it before. French colonialism and its activities in Africa is a feature constantly in the parliament, and there are a huge number of French people, MEPs, on the AFET, the Foreign Affairs Committee, and the Security and Defence. And a certain irony that we had our aforementioned Nathalie Loiseau, chair of the Security and Defence Committee, who went on RTE to talk about us, that when I mentioned at the Security and Defence Committee in response to one of the French members saying that now a majority of the French people are against their intervention in the Sahel, and I welcome that, and she said she preferred to see comments about France left to people from France. So I hope she's listening in today to hear this, because it didn't stop her making comments about people in Ireland on Irish radio.
So yeah, let's go top impression of France. We have a rating that we do every week, which is about the performance and impact of the country in the European Parliament. What were you going to say, Claire?
They're big hitters. Like, yeah, they're a 7 or an 8. That doesn't mean that's good, yeah, but it means they've a big intervention here. But what I will say is that there's a lot of talk of, will French become the dominant language now that the Brits are gone? It won't. English is the international language here, and that's going to stay. It's very clear now.
I think France is an amazing country, and I even found it has more than double, for example, it has more than double the social housing of Ireland. Mm. The social housing is over 19%. But yet, at the same time, we are seeing a massive swing to the right in France.
Huge,
and the anti-Muslim feeling is right across the board. And they're bringing in laws that would be described as blatantly racist anywhere else. And the European Union is turning a blind eye to what the French are doing in that area. Yeah. And it is nothing but direct discrimination against the Muslim
community.
And
they've also a really militarised police force as well. There were deaths during the Yellow Vests protests. The targeting of Muslims has been deemed to be in breach of all international law, really. You know, some of the targeting is just vicious racism, and it's getting worse.
And it has one of the most polarised countries in Europe on the question of Europe. And we see that in every election, there's a big split about very pro-European and very, very anti-European. And unlike Britain, if France were to leave the EU or to get anywhere closer to that, it would really rock the boat to a whole other level. Very interesting country.
And just on the last point, which we really have, we should go into it another time, right? But in actual fact, there's a lot of French on the Foreign Affairs Committee and Security and Defence, and there's actually a strong scepticism about NATO and about the Americans with some of the French. And because the French actually think that they are a military might in their own right, and that they can actually function without NATO, without the Americans. But they don't all think that. Mm. And Macron, unfortunately, has been an absolute poodle to the Americans.
Mm. Alors, ça c'est tout. Thanks for listening. And next week, we need to pick our country for next week. So will you take us something out of the hat there, Claire?
Oh, my God.
Germany.
No. I took it. Sorry, you might get your hand off that now. I got it on.
Get your hand
the
out of
Netherlands.
Netherlands.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's all right. It's okay. I don't mind being lorded over as usual.
I'm okay.
Right. Good luck.
A bientôt.
Au revoir.